5.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow is a forgotten poet as a matter of literary fashion, but his poetry is literally unforgettable, like nursery rhymes or the bedrock folk songs. Here is a universal classic, Longfellow's A Psalm of Life, read by Hal Holbrook.
Tell me not in mournful numbers life is but an empty dream. For the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end or way, but to act, that each tomorrow find us farther than today. Art is long, and time is fleeting. In our hearts, though stout and brave, still like muffled drums are beating funeral marches to the grave. In the world's broad field of battle, in the bivouac of life, be not like dumb, driven cattle. Be a hero in the strife. Trust no future, howe'er pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act, act in the living present, heart within and God o'erhead. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. Footprints that perhaps another sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother seeing, shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait.
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow gave us, in those rolling, uplifting, still resonant poems, a whole phrase book of the American language, not just those footprints in the sands of time, but the spreading chestnut tree, the ships that pass in the night, the counsel that into each life some rain must fall, all Longfellow. Before Whitman or Hawthorne and Melville, Longfellow embodied the American Renaissance, the assurance that American themes, whether Hiawatha and Miles Standish or Paul Revere, and American language like his own, could throw off the European chains. In a lifetime's work, he gave the world some of its most recitable poetry. He urged us, for example, in one of his poems, he said, "Then read from the treasured volume the poem of thy choice, and lend to the rhyme of the poet the beauty of thy voice, and the night shall be filled with music, and the cares that infest the day shall fold their tents like the Arabs and as silently steal away." Connection listeners, we're rediscovering Longfellow this hour with the editor of his reemergence in the Library of America series, J.D. McClatchy. J.D. McClatchy is a poet, a critic, and a teacher. He's the chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. Welcome, J.D. McClatchy, and thank you for this volume. So much fun to stop almost anywhere and remember these things that, I don't know, does anybody not know the children's hour that begins between the dark and the daylight when the night is beginning to lower, comes a pause in the day's occupations that is known as the children's hour? It's wonderful stuff. How do we ever let it go? Or did we?
No, I didn't. I think it's just sort of buried itself in our memories. It's not something we read anymore, something we remember. I suppose I'm 55 years old. I think I was the last generation of school children that was made to memorize these poems in school. Although I do have a younger friend who was made to memorize them, but that was because he had misbehaved in class. I think that's the first to the next step towards extinction. Nowadays, I don't know what either kids read in school or at home, but they're not reading Longfellow anymore.
This used to be the absolute definition of what poetry was all about, ballads and rhymes and emotion. It has become to be the just the perfect example of what poetry is not about in the present world. How does a poet evaluate Longfellow more than a century later?
Well, I think readers nowadays have either dim memories or lazy habits of reading, and they tend to dismiss Longfellow as a sentimental, kitschy, even, Victorian poet. But it's based not on an actual rereading of the poems. Often the poems are astonishing in their lyric grace, their narrative energies. It's something that readers have forgotten, and this is why the Library of America hopes that putting this volume out again will put a new perspective on a really remarkable career and try to bring Longfellow back into the curriculum.
What's great about the best of it, in your own view?
Well, that's a very complicated question because his achievement is so varied. If he just wrote one kind of poem, which is what poets nowadays tend to do, we could answer a question like that more easily. But in fact, well, I suppose the easiest way to put it is he is a Victorian man of letters with all of the prodigious energies that term implies. I mean, he got a start early on. He knew when he was a young man in college that he wanted to pursue a literary career. He knew exactly what he wanted to do from the very beginning. And he was...
Tell the story. Born in Maine.
Born in Maine in 1807. Very distinguished father and mother. Both of his grandparents were congressmen. His grandfather was a colleague and fellow general with Washington. His father was a good friend of Lafayette. Maine at that point was a territory. But he was born in and grew up in the first brick house in Portland, Maine. His parents were well-to-do and influential. He read, he went to local schools. He was admitted to Bowdoin College in Maine when he was 14 and graduated when he was 18. His classmate was Nathaniel Hawthorne. And from the very beginning, he was an enormous reader. And his first published poem appeared in the Portland Gazette at age 13. So he was a very dedicated and as we say nowadays, focused young man. And but he wasn't to be the kind of writer that we think of certain other writers as being. He wasn't interested in the kind of thumping American vigor. From the very start as well, he was interested in opening up American literature to the resources of European tradition to make American literature something more cosmopolitan than it had been. Now, the poem that Hal Holbrook read at the very beginning, The Psalm of Life, a poem that probably came to plague Hawthorne, since all for decades later young ladies would be writing and asking him to copy out stanzas about the footprints on the sands of time. And it appeared in his first book, and it seems slightly comic to us today, the kind of earnestness of it. But in fact, when it first appeared, along with startling lectures by Emerson, it ran that whole sense of be up and doing and the energies and brightness of life ran quite contrary to a kind of Puritan, dour view that young people were raised with at Harvard or at Yale in years like that. It seemed remarkably exciting to the young people of the time. I think it's not a tone that he was interested in pursuing. In fact, his own temperament tended to be rather melancholy. And I think his later poems show that side of him rather than this youthful poem. And that's a side of him. His growing up in Maine made him particularly interested in the sea and his wonderful ballads about the sea and the rhythms of life on the coast. But that sense of melancholy, that sense of something deep in the heart, a kind of sadness, a kind of longing, comes up in poems after poem.
We'll come to that, and we'll come to some of the strangely tragic events of his life. But you say it was not a thumping Americanism, and yet, I mean, he was proudly American voice, and he goes right into American themes pretty early. I mean, he authored Tales of the Wayside in Paul Revere, right. That kind of stuff. What's the first and most important of those American statements? And maybe you ought to give us a sample of it.
Well, probably Evangeline is the first of those. He lived at a fortunate time, I think. His life essentially spans the 19th century. Born in 1807, died in 1882. And it was a time of tumultuous events in America, the westward expansion, the question of slavery, the Civil War, all of these questions he addressed in his work. It was also a time when, directly after the Revolutionary War, when Americans were particularly interested in defining themselves. The definition of an American changes century to century, but the 19th century, over the course of it, was the first time that Americans became fascinated by what is it that we are, what is it that we've made. And Americans didn't have a history. Americans temperamentally don't much care for history, that sense of each American starting out all over again for himself or herself seems to be a note. And what Longfellow did, what Longfellow had the sense to do, was to create a kind of mythology, a kind of folklore for Americans by taking episodes from the past, giving them a kind of poetic density and vigor and color that sunk into the imaginations of America and became their past. Now, Longfellow, for example, happens to have been a descendant of John Alden and Priscilla Mullins on the Mayflower. When he told the story of the strange courtship of Miles Standish, his brusque kind of shyness and Priscilla's interest in having John Alden speak for himself, he was writing a bit of family history and made it into a national story, the same way with Paul Revere's wife. Evangeline, the first of those stories, was actually a story of the famous Acadian removal of the French-speaking colony down to Louisiana, the separation of the young lovers Evangeline and Gabriel, the search over the years of one for another, until finally, by chance, she is a nurse in a hospital in Philadelphia and tends to the dying man who had been her beloved. It's a very sentimental story, a heartbreaking story, and soon the copies of that poem were in every household in America. But it was a story that was originally Nathaniel Hawthorne wanted to make into a novel. And at dinner one night, he said he had some questions about whether he had time to work on it. And he said to Longfellow, "Why don't you write this story?" And Longfellow was immediately taken by it. But what you see about that, the famous opening of it in the forest primeval and so on, it's written in dactylic hexameters, a technical term, not a usual way to write a poem in English, and it's certainly not in American. In fact, when the poem appeared, some critics complained that it seemed too experimental, not a word that anybody would think to use with Longfellow nowadays, except in his own day. It happens to be the meter of classical epics. It's the meter of Homer and of Virgil. So that implicitly what Longfellow is doing here is taking a humble story, a homemade story, and writing about it in an epic way to raise the small story into a larger myth about the endurance of love and in the midst of exile and heartbreak. And I think he had a way of, it's a wonderful collusion between his poetic skill and his material to make this material so memorable.
I wish you'd give us a little taste of it.
If I can find
on
it.
Page 57, it starts.
Page 57.
As much as you like.
It begins this way. "This is the forest primeval, the murmuring pines and the hemlocks bearded with moss, and in garments green, indistinct in the twilight, stand like the druids of Eld, with voices sad and prophetic. Stand like harpers hoar with beards that rest on their bosoms, loud from its rocky caverns, the deep-voiced neighboring ocean speaks, and in accents disconsolate answers the wail of the forest." So there's quite a sonorous music there. You hear the kind of organ note struck. There's a wonderful expansiveness and in majesty to the language that elevates the story, I think, and makes it quite memorable. He had a wonderful knack for, he paid attention to his readers in ways that other poets may not have. He knew what their hearts and memories had in them, and he could put things in a way. Robert Frost did that later, his real descendant of Longfellow. Why is it that certain poems sink into the national consciousness, like Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening? Why is it that we all remember lines of Longfellow? Hard question to answer, but there's something, some connection to the heart and the ear that makes these lines, these images, so lasting.
Maybe it's phrases like "Gitche Gumee," or "I wish you'd give us a little bit of the Song of Hiawatha," which I don't know as well as I should.
It's a remarkable story. I mean, Longfellow was the first poet who was attracted in a serious way to the lives and culture of Indian tribes. He depended quite a bit on the scholarship of Schoolcraft, whose books, who'd gone to live with the Indians and to learn their customs. It's not, on the face of it, promising material. He didn't know exactly what to do with it until, this is an example of his cosmopolitan instincts, he was rereading the Finnish epic, the Kalevala. I should add, by the way, that Longfellow spoke 11 languages, and Finnish was one of them. He was reading the Kalevala and was particularly struck by the meter. At once, he realized that this is the way he could write up the story of Hiawatha. It's a bouncing kind of meter, trochaic tetrameter, but has an odd similarity to sort of tom-tom music almost. There's something, and it's not just the meter, it's the kinds of repetitions that he employs in here, a kind of ritualized language that makes it seem exotic. Here's a little bit, for example, from Book 3, Hiawatha's Childhood. By the shores of Gitche Gumee, by the shining big sea water, stood the wigwam of Nokomis, daughter of the moon, Nokomis. Dark behind it rose the forest, rose the black and gloomy pine trees, rose the firs with cones upon them. Bright before it beat the water, beat the clear and sunny water, beat the shining big sea water, and so on it goes. There's a wonderful kind of, there's kinds of ritualized repetitions that make it so compelling.
You know, everybody once upon a time knew the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. We've been reminded by the historian David Hackett Fisher that this was, of course, it's a memory of the American Revolution, but it was written as a kind of rallying cry in the Civil War. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow was an important abolitionist, and this was a kind of call to arms in his time. Maybe we'll come back to that. We're talking this hour about the poetry of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the most popular poet in the English language, maybe, of all time. A hero in Europe, decorated everywhere, known, beloved, forgotten, even while he was and remains beloved. He's now out most of his poetry in a single handy volume from the Library of America, edited by our guest J.D. McClatchy. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Longfellow connection. Bill is on the line.
Good morning, Chris.
Welcome, Bill.
By the way, that Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, that comes from his Tales of a Wayside Inn, which is kind of like the American equivalent to Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Your guest at the very beginning had mentioned that Longfellow wrote in different styles, and nothing could be more illustrative than that than by reading his Tales of a Wayside Inn. You've got one poetic style, then another, then another. I'm at a loss to explain why he isn't more popular today either. His writing was absolutely riveting, unbelievably good. In that Tales of Wayside Inn, he has a poem called Torquemada. It had to do with the Spanish Inquisition. And you read that poem, and when you're done with it, the hair on the back of your head is standing up straight. You feel cold as a corpse. It is unbelievably good. I mean, most of the Tales of Wayside Inn, not all of it. There are a couple of poems there, like The Birds. I think it's called The Birds of Chillingworth. Did nothing for me. Excuse me?
Killingworth.
Thank you, sir.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, you also mentioned his Finnish connection. He had some poems on King Olaf. I think I'm pronouncing, it's been a while since I've read them. And that series of poems, I can't tell you that I understood everything that Longfellow was trying to make, all the points he was trying to make, but you got done reading that section, and you found yourself thinking about it days and days later, and going back and reviewing it again. His Skeleton in Armor was an excellent poem. I mean, an epic poem. I mean, the lines from Evangeline, certain sections of it just move you to tears. Absolutely beautiful piece of work. I enjoy reading him very much.
How did you come by him, Bill?
It was accidental. When I first started, it was in the 50s, I was in parochial school. And, of course, we had to read, the Village Smithy Stands and, certain poems, the basic poems. And needless to say, being someone, 8, 9, 10, 11, I was totally bored. But then I rediscovered him in high school, and then I was eating at the Wayside Inn in Sudbury about 4 or 5 years ago, and the book was for sale there. I figured, what the heck, I like poetry. And my God, was that a good purchase. It was just for that one poem alone I was telling you about, Torquemada, it was well worth it. As I said before, the different literary styles there, just when you think you've got him pegged, he comes up with a style. Some of it sounds quite modern, I think.
Bill, you're terrific. I want J.D. McClatchy to sort of welcome you to the Longfellow
Lodge. Because I think Bill's experience is that of many readers who nowadays have to come upon Longfellow almost accidentally. It's a very curious cultural question, this great shift in tastes that sometimes occur in literary history. It certainly was true around 1920. When the big modernist poets, T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, came to the fore, wanted to revolutionize literary tastes, wanted to sweep out what they considered to be old-fashioned, sentimental poetry. They also wanted to get rid of narrative poetry. They wanted something that they wanted the fragment. They wanted the tortured ego. They wanted everything that we now think something angular and ironic. The first thing to go, of course, was someone like Longfellow, who wrote big, sweeping, romantic, adventurous poems that seemed kitsch to. It wasn't modern to like something like
Bill,
that.
Bill, three cheers for your find and for sticking with your instinct. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Longfellow connection. Peter is on the line.
Hi, I'm Peter Davison. I'm the poetry editor of the Atlantic Monthly, which is a
magazine. Oh, Peter, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. It's a magazine that Henry Wadsworth Longfellow helped found, so I have always had a devotion to him in many years. But I really got hooked by Longfellow when I was about 12 years old in a book, in a large anthology called My Book House, The Treasure Chest. And it had in it poems like The Skeleton in Armor, or Balder the Beautiful is Dead, or poems about Thor the Thunderer. The things that first attracted me were these amazing poems in which the European experience was registered, was delivered in a way that was, what Mr. McClatchy said, it's so powerful, this narrative quality. I also used to hear Robert Frost talk about Longfellow with tremendous enthusiasm. Poe and Longfellow were the two American poets that he spoke of with most interest.
He loved Emerson, too.
Well, he liked Emerson, too, but he used to argue with Emerson. Longfellow and Poe, he just accepted as wonderful poets. There was a little poem of his, I can't remember it, maybe you do, Sandy, a little one about the flight into Egypt.
Yes.
Which he was one of his favorite poems. He used to recite it from memory, which alas I can't do. Maybe you could read it.
Are you talking about Sands and the Hourglass?
I think so. They're traveling. Joseph and Mary are traveling to Egypt, and the donkey speaks. You know the one I mean? I was looking for it over the weekend. I couldn't find it.
I don't think that was in the book that we have in front of us.
Oh, isn't it? Too bad. It was a sort of obscure poem, but it was a pretty thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, I think, you made, I think, a very good point about the quality that is common to Longfellow and Frost is they have this sense of the hypnotic, the sense of what you can remember. Frost used to say that his poetry was something, he wanted to write poems that would be like a burr out of under the saddle, that you couldn't get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens with Longfellow. Remember, there's a great moment in the later stages of World War II when Churchill was welcoming Roosevelt to the war and suddenly started reciting in some speech Ceylon, Ceylon, O ship of state, Ceylon, O union strong and great. From the building of the ship with some marvelous lines in that poem. They are these hypnotic qualities. One doesn't go to Longfellow for deep thinking, but you certainly go to him for that kind of hypnotic memory, that music.
Peter Davison, thank you so much for calling. One of the things about Longfellow that's important is that he inspired great music from the world's greatest composer in his time. When we come back, we'll talk, among other things, with J.D. McClatchy about the music that Longfellow's poetry inspired. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Longfellow Connection. Fellow's poem, The Children's Hour. It's the music of Charles Ives, sung by Roberta Alexander, accompanied by Tan Crone on the piano. This is a fragment of the musical Longfellow. All manner of American and European composers, including great names like Liszt and Elgar, put Longfellow to music. J.D. McClatchy is our guest. He's the editor of the Library of America Longfellow. Explain the musician's interest in Longfellow.
Well, it's any musician's interest in finding a good text and a popular text. I think at last count there's something like 700 settings of Longfellow poems.
Wow.
By composers that, from Mendelssohn on through, as you mentioned, Elgar and Samuel Coleridge Taylor, the African-English composer, wrote wonderful.
Yeah, setting. We heard him going into the break, yeah.
Wonderful. And on through an extraordinary group of American composers, particularly in the early part of this century, composers like Mrs. Beach, George Chadwick, Arthur Foote, on down to contemporaries like Ned Roram and David Diamond. The appeal is remarkable, I think, because of the exactness with which Longfellow's prosody works. I think that appeals to a composer's ear because the words are so exactly placed.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Longfellow connection, or you can join us online at theconnection.org. John Hollander joins us by phone from Yale. John Hollander, the poet and professor. Also, if I may say, it's the least of your accomplishments, perhaps, John Hollander, but I think of you as a great authority on poetry to be memorized, poetry to be recited, and what in the world is better than Longfellow?
Well, it was wonderful for those purposes. A lot of Longfellow's poems were used again and again and again throughout the 19th and earlier 20th centuries when young people, for example, had to what was called speak a piece, which was meant that in middle-class homes, a child would come down and before the assembled guests would produce a bit of recited verse. Longfellow, particularly the shorter narratives, were perfect for that purpose. I was interested in the caller earlier who said that he had had to memorize some Longfellow at school, and it was probably the village blacksmith, and didn't like it very much. I remember coming to Longfellow just a completely different way. My mother was a very comical and very widely read lady who used to make fun of all the sentimental set pieces of Longfellow. So I grew up feeling that it was all right to feel that they were corny and silly.
You mean corny but good?
Corny, famous, celebrated corny. Maybe that's really wasn't what great poetry was about. And I think that in the decline of that sort of recitation, particularly of a narrative poem, Longfellow went. I came back to admiring him over the past 30 years or so. And in funny ways, it was particular poems which would get to me. I was particularly interested, of course, in how the whole, as Sandy McClatchy said, the whole modernist agenda was completely missing from this body of poetry. Mm. And even Robert Frost is so radically modernist a poet compared to Longfellow, even though he felt close to him, and even though the refrain of that wonderful poem of Longfellow's, My Lost Youth, becomes a title phrase of his first book.
John Hollander, I'm wondering which of the... Give us one or two of the favorites that you come back to for all time after... You know, after 30 years.
Well, the poems that I would recommend, somebody who thinks that Longfellow is worthless, I suggest I could give you just a short list of poems to read.
Yeah, please.
The Bells of San Blas, a wonderful poem of a sort of a New England, extremely progressive Protestant view of what the old Catholic religion was. A poem called The Fire of Driftwood, which is marvelous. A poem called The Jewish Cemetery at Newport. My Last Youth that I mentioned, a poem called The Harvest Moon, a sonnet called The Cross of Snow, another one called Mezzo Camin, a poem called Seaweed. These are quite wonderful as opposed to The Psalm of Life and The Village Blacksmith and such poems, which are the ones that, of course, most look like parodies of Longfellow.
I wish one of you...
Poem, The Wreck of the Hesperus.
Yes.
Which was just that kind of... narrative my mother mocked at me. I remember mocked for me saying, it was the schooner Hesperus. They sailed the wintry sea, and the skipper had taken his little daughter to bear him company. And on the other hand, when I got to know something about poetry, I heard in that narrative style, I heard tremendous echoes of the border ballad of Sir Patrick Spence, just the way, indeed, Coleridge had heard it and used it at the beginning of Dejection, so much so that he even has in one line, then up and spake an old sailor had sailed the Spanish Main, with an artificial stress on sailor, because that occurs in Sir Patrick Spence. And then when I heard James Merrill read this poem aloud, which I hadn't taken much care to think about for
decades and decades, I heard him read it, and suddenly the dialogue between the little girl and the father, they're both going to drown in all this, I suddenly heard in it obviously Longfellow had been hearing, which is Goethe's poem called Erlkönig, the Earl King, within celebrated Schubert setting. I don't know if he knew the Schubert setting or not. He might very well have, but he certainly knew the Goethe poem. And that all came back in this, and I saw all sorts of wonderful dimensions in the poem as a very, very sophisticated literary piece of craftsmanship that I had never really seen before.
I wish John Hollander, you or Sandy McGlaithy would talk about The Cross of Snow, because not only is one of your favorites, but it's a very important part of the life story. Sandy McGlaithy, would you...
I'd be happy to.
Tell us and maybe read it.
I'd be happy to. It's a poem that Longfellow never published in his lifetime. It only came out in a biography after he died because of its very private nature. Longfellow's second marriage to Fanny Appleton was a spectacularly happy one. His first wife had died after a miscarriage, and 7 years later he married his second wife, and they had 6 children. She was rich, she was supportive, they were enormously devoted to one another. And then in 1861, one summer day in July, she and 2 of her small daughters were in the living room, the parlor room of their house in Cambridge. She had snipped curls from the daughter's hair and was sending them to a friend. And she was sealing with wax the little package of her daughter's curls when the candle used for the sealing wax accidentally fell and set fire to her light summer dress. She ran from the room into Longfellow's study. He instantly saw what was happening and tried to save his wife, putting out the fire, wrapping her in a rug, but it was no use. Again, she struggled away from the poet and ran out towards the front door for some reason, as if to escape, and eventually collapsed in the front hall. She was carried up to bed. Doctors were called, and the next day she died. On July 13th, 2 days later, she was buried. It was their 18th wedding anniversary on which she was buried. And Longfellow himself was so badly burned that he could not even attend the burial of his wife. And in fact, the image we have of him, and the image that's on the cover of the Library of America edition, a famous Julia Margaret Cameron photograph of him and a big white beard looking very bardic, he actually grew that beard and his hair get white because his burns were so bad trying to save his wife that he could never shave again, and he had to grow the beard that we now recognize him by. He was completely devastated by the death of his wife, and eventually he had his children and his work to console him, but he was never the same again. And one day, 18 years after the death of his wife, he's lying in his bed, the very bed in which she died, and he looks on the wall and he sees her picture there on the wall. And also nearby was a photograph of a mountain in Colorado that, by a natural fault or ravine in the mountain, holds the snow in it longer than the snow might last. And it forms a cross, a natural cross on the side of the mountain. He looked at both of these pictures, and he wrote this poem called The Cross of Snow, a sonnet. It has one odd word in it, benedite, which is an older fashioned word meaning blessed. Here's the poem. In the long, sleepless watches of the night, a gentle face, the face of one long dead, looks at me from the wall, where round its head the night lamp casts a halo of pale light. Here, in this room, she died. And soul more white never through martyrdom of fire was led to its repose, nor can in books be read the legend of a life more benedite. There is a mountain in the distant west that, sun-defying, in its deep ravines, displays a cross of snow upon its side. Such is the cross I wear upon my breast these 18 years. Through all the changing scenes and seasons, changeless since the day she died.
Well read.
That very powerful but very literal and confessional mode is, as a matter of fact, very, very, very contemporary. So much late modernist or postmodernist poetry has, of course, reverted, without knowing it's about doing it, reverted back to a lot of the things that modernism did not admire so much. And that's a poem which, with certain changes, you could find, that is, if it was simply put into free verse and not written so well, you could find on almost any magazine publishing nothing but poetry today. About modernism's not liking Longfellow, I think I can give a very good example of what modern poetry didn't like, and a counterexample from, I think, one of Longfellow's most remarkable poems, one of his shortest, which is completely a modern poem, and you could see that if you know Robert Frost's poetry, you could hear how this poem fed into a lot of early Frost very much. It's a poem called Aftermath, and he published it in the metaphorical aftermath of having finished Tales of a Wayside Inn. As a matter of fact, it appeared in the volume which contained the last of the tales. So it was about that project being finished and what about what happens after the harvest. But it's not just a personal poem about Longfellow having finished a long poem. That is, if it were only about that, it would be just like a letter to a friend. No, it becomes something very, very general about phases of human accomplishment. It's a beautiful poem, and well, let me just read it.
Please.
Called Aftermath.
John Hollander, thank you. Go ahead.
When the summer fields are mown, when the birds are fledged and flown, and the dry leaves strew the path, with the falling of the snow, with the cawing of the crow, once again the fields we mow and gather in the aftermath. Not the sweet new grass with flowers is this harvesting of ours. Not the upland clover bloom, but the rowan mixed with weeds, tangled tufts from marsh and meads, where the poppy drops its seeds in the silence and the gloom. This is a very beautiful poem and very unlike most of Longfellow, because it doesn't go on to tell you what it's really about and how you're to think about it, and he doesn't give a little sermon on the text he's written. Compare it, for example, with another poem of his, which I feel he ruins by doing just that. It's a poem called Snowflakes, which I otherwise like. It goes, out of the bosom of the air, out of the cloud folds of her garments shaken, over the woodlands brown and bare, over the harvest fields forsaken, silent and soft and slow descends the snow. And then he's now hitting you over the head with what he's done in the second stanza. Even as our cloudy fancies take suddenly shape in some divine expression, even as the troubled heart doth make in the white countenance confession, the troubled sky reveals the grief it feels. One wants to just blue pencil that out of the whole thing and go to the last stanza, which does all that work in a more, what we would call a more poetic way. This is the poem of the air, slowly in silent syllables recorded. This is the secret of despair long in its cloudy bosom hoarded, now whispered and revealed to wood and field. And if it were just the first and the last stanza, it would be a marvelous, marvelous poem. And it's that, even as our cloudy fancies take suddenly shape in some divine expression, and the syntax and diction of that second stanza aren't very good either. So this is one of the problems. But the Aftermath poems, I think, just gorgeous.
John Hollander, you're gorgeous. Stand by for a call or two, will you? 1-800-423-8255. Maria is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Maria.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to share that I had to memorize Evangeline in sophomore year high school.
Not the whole time.
And, no, just the beginning, or actually what your guest read earlier. And I'm grateful for that. I remember very little from high school, but I'm very grateful for remembering that because I'm a big hiker now up in the White Mountains. And often I come upon a stand of hemlocks and, you know, am given the opportunity to very theatrically recite that part of Evangeline to the amazement of my fellow hikers.
The forest primeval goes with you, Maria. Good.
Yes, and, you know, I feel like that's, you know, a great testament from Longfellow to our natural heritage here in New England.
Hmm. Well, hip, hip, thank you, and keep doing it. 1-800-423-8255. Jim is calling from Fitzwilliam, New Hampshire.
Hello.
Hello, Jim. Good.
I was very interested in the constant comparisons with Frost and Longfellow because one of the things they share is a seeming superficiality that sometimes plunges into great depth. And the example I use, by the way, poetry reading is not dead reading of chestnuts. Most people love Longfellow, just the academics maybe who have left him behind. I do a lot of reading of chestnuts, and I often read The Children's Hour. And if you just look at that, the little lines in there about the Bishop of Bingen in his mouse tower on the Rhine, you realize that it's not nearly so benevolent a picture of children clambering around in an older man that it looks like. The mice devoured the Bishop of Bingen because he was so greedy. In the story that Longfellow is alluding to. And all of a sudden, the poem takes on a very, very dark note right in the middle of it.
Is it dark or just playful? In the next line, he says, "Do you think, oh blue-eyed banditti, because you have scaled the wall, such an old moustache as I am, is not a match for you all?" Isn't this Grandpa sort of playing
there.
With the kids?
There is a darkness there. Yes, of course it's playful. The same thing is true of Frost. Speaking of playfulness, Mr. Hollander did not say that he has written at one point that his mother did not name him Jonathan Hollander because she did not want his name to sound like a line out of Evangeline.
That's funny. 1-800-423-8255. Thank you, Jim. Mary is calling from Westerly, Rhode Island.
Yes, good morning.
Morning, Mary.
My son left me a memo last night. He's a librarian in Middletown. He left me a memo to listen. Because he knows Longfellow is my very favorite.
Hmm.
My mother taught in one of the last one-room schoolhouses in New Fairfield, Connecticut. So you see, I had an early, I was exposed early to poetry, and much of it was Longfellow. But this is what I wanted to tell you. My husband and I were in Ireland about 15 years ago, and we stopped at a little church for Mass on a Sunday morning, and there was the village blacksmith of the little village of Kilkee in the County Clare had died, and when it came time for the priest to give a eulogy, he said, "I'm going to read the village blacksmith." So I sat there riveted to think that way off in Ireland, this New England poet's poem was being read and to honor the village blacksmith. And he was carried outside, and his sons carried him on their shoulders down to the burial ground, and all you could hear was the clip, 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 clop of the horse's hooves. It was very touching.
I could add, Mary, that Longfellow, just a couple of years after his death, a plaque was erected in his honor in Poets' Corner at Westminster Abbey. And to this day, he remains the only non-English poet in Poets' Corner at Westminster Abbey. It was a tribute to his remarkable popularity in his time and to somebody's sense that he is still very much alive around the world.
I wonder, does the revival of Longfellow have anything in common with the revival of Kipling? I mean, they are these sort of grandly national, rhyming, epic, you know, balladic, recitable, memorizable.
It's very true.
Wonderfully flowing guys.
What's nice about shifts in taste is that sometimes the fog clears and we can see a poet's true achievement in Kipling's case and now in Longfellow's, and forget political ideology and look at what still touches the heart.
Yeah. This is wonderful fun, and we should be doing it once a week. John Hollander, thank you for joining us. Especially Sandy McClatchy, thank you for this volume, and thank you for joining us on The Connection. Listeners, you can continue the Longfellow orgy on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. Thanks for help today from Tim Monroe. Darren Manoogian and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
This is WBUR. Coming up next on Here and Now at Noon, we'll meet a woman who went out to buy a package of hot dogs and wound up driving home in a Rolls Royce. Hot Dog, the story, coming up on Here and Now.